Welcome to the Omfit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Omfit DMI Podcast. This is Bhavin Patel from London, and today we talk to Judd Kaplane, Global Head of Banking and Capital Markets at KPMG, and Olivier Dang, Global Chief Operating Officer for Wholesale Digital Office at Nomura. In today's discussion, we hope to briefly discuss the digitization trends, how new initiatives can be successful as solutions and architectures require more focus and finesse than simply bolting on new pieces of technology. We will also discuss how banks must negotiate a multitude of shifting factors, from changing customer behaviors to economic headwinds, intensifying competition, regulatory pressures, and technological disruption. So thank you, Judd and Olivier, for joining me today. Judd, I'll start with you. So right now we are seeing a lot of potential innovation occurring at both the front and back end of the banking ecosystem. On the one hand, there is a lot of opportunities to reduce and optimize a lot of the back office banking processes in areas such as liquidity management, settlement reconciliation of transactions, and FX via technologies like DLT. On the other hand, there is also a lot of competitive pressure from the consumer-facing front end, where open banking regimes and the involvement of tech fins and fintechs are looking to provide more value-added and cross-cutting financial services. Which innovation area, from your perspective, should retail banks prioritize investment and innovation in at this point in the new landscape of digital financial services?
Bhavin, so I think it'd be helpful to first give a backdrop to what's emerged with COVID over the last 12 months or so. One, I think, as everyone knows, we've seen a significant acceleration of digital banking, both in terms of number of customers as well as functionality being used. When I talk about functionality, meaning an increase by about a third of remote deposits, significant increase in online mortgage applications, which, by the way, is the most paper-intensive part of banking, right through remote wealth advice, which I find very interesting. In addition, the entire distribution of banking is being rethought, everything from the future of the branch, right through the role of call centers, and right through video advice, you know, such as the wealth example I just used. You know, having said that, I think there are probably three or four areas that banks need to invest in, and it all begins with AI, as most people would probably expect. So, you know, we refer to something as vision AI, which is when you walk into a branch, you get recognized right away, potentially as a good customer, and need to be treated differently. Another example of vision AI would be at the ATM, and the ability to quickly detect fraud based on what the individual is doing, but probably more importantly, just their body language and face recognition. And in some respects, that's not too different than what we have in airports and around what the government looks at in terms of identifying, quote, the bad guy based on body language. So once again, one is the vision AI. The second area is around voice analytics, also using AI, and specifically in contact centers. And this is around the ability to analyze sentiment, words that should be used. And when I say words that should be used, meaning giving the contact center rep, you know, online information around how to talk to a potentially a 25-year-old differently than a 75-year-old, right through, once again, using AI and the ability to have more information at that individual's fingertips around products that can be sold more quickly, or meaning information to provide that call center rep to sell products more quickly. Third area that banks should be investing in, which I find very interesting and really as a result of COVID, is the branch interface. And when you think about it, when individuals pre-COVID walked into a branch, opened a new account, you know, applied for a mortgage loan, things like that, the customer may have either input that into the, you know, the bank's technology, you know, and or filled out paper applications. What I'm suggesting with this branch interface is to put the interface on the customer's phone or device and allow him or her to do it online, connecting into the bank. And then the final comment, which I've referenced a couple of times, is just simply video advice. And certainly with consumer banking, so you think of a call center rep with Zoom technology and other technologies, much easier to talk to a person through the computer screen. But I think where it really has relevance is with wealth management. And I think, as most of us know, wealth management requires more of that one-to-one relationship. And in these national contact centers, or I won't even call them club, I'll call them contact centers, you know, allows that wealth advice to take place through the computer screen. It also allows that bank to have greater regional reach than they do just, you know, with the constraints of a branch network.
Shifting the conversation to the wholesale banking sector, does the nature and the focus of what banking innovation is needed and valued shift slightly for dealing with bank-to-bank interactions with corporates?
Thanks, Bhavin, and thanks for having me on your podcast. As Jude mentioned, I think definitely the industry overall is going through significant changes, accelerated really by the COVID pandemic. And on the wholesale side, it's not really any different to retail, except, but maybe I'd say our institutional clients are themselves going through their own digital transformation. So the change is it needs to accelerate even further on the wholesale side. I think what are the key structural changes that we see for our type of business is really around the electronification of the asset classes, which is progressing at a very rapid pace, where even on the last kind of eras where it was still quite voice driven, the bond trading aspect now is moving very quickly into digital, with volumes on some of the electronic bond trading platform really doubling or tripling in the last couple of years. And similarly, whereas digital assets were considered pretty much a fringe asset 3-4 years ago, now are increasingly being recognized as a key asset class with growing institutional participation. And of course, linked a bit to the comments from Jude around AI, the amount of data that is being created on the wholesale side and therefore that needs to be analyzed in order to gain some insight and gain some market share is significant and needs to be analyzed at all the steps of the value chain and with the client interactions. And so for wholesale banks having to position themselves in that new normal, while also at the same time tackling the legacy system, the regulation, the pressure from clients, and the new risks that are increasing from this, such as, you know, cyber data leakage and so on, is a significant challenge, but also at the same time creates a lot of opportunities where, you know, we can think about launching new businesses or enter new segments given the lower cost to entry driven by the technology. So where should banks like us, wholesale banks, focus our innovation? In my view, we need to leverage the digital playbook, focusing both on the top line and the bottom line. And of course, being quite differentiated on whether the impact is an incremental one or a disruptive one. And for incremental type of opportunities, such as improving your core business profitability, and those are typically projects with a short to mid-term time frame, here, you know, the execution should be really driven by the business line and making sure that the functions that are going to be impacted are fully accountable here and drive the change here. A lot of that is linked to data and AI. And here, you know, without repeating what Jude was saying, we face the same challenge and the same opportunities on the wholesale side. You know, if wholesale banks haven't done it yet, they should migrate all of their data to a kind of cloud so that the information is readily available, and then deploying relatively basic analytics tool, making sure that all the functions have access to the same kind of a source and data. And that allows then on top of it to build a lot of machine learning or AI-driven capabilities. And in most banks, you know, I'd say we do that fairly well on structured data, so generating alpha or generating information from a historical kind of transactions that are recorded in different systems. Where it still is relatively challenging is around the analysis of unstructured data. And when you think of it on a bank like us, we deal with clients on chats, on voice, on kind of email. And trying to generate insight from that is not necessarily easy because you need to first reconstruct what a trade is. And sometimes on the more complex trades, they are built across multiple messages, and it's not always easy for an AI engine to recognize what is the trade and therefore what insight it should derive from that. So lots of efforts are going through that, but I don't think yet, at least for most banks, very yet. And then as I've mentioned, the increase in electronification means that if banks haven't done it yet, they need to significantly upgrade their electronic platform both in terms of the backend, but also the user interface. And more, you know, you get the what you see from the consumer apps, or clients expect to see that in their kind of professional apps or interface when they deal with people like us. And that, of course, is a challenge because we don't necessarily think like this in a wholesale bank. And when it comes to more disruptive opportunities, those are, in my mind, at least the opportunities that have the potential for significant revenue or valuation upside over the next 3 to 5 years. Here we need to think about areas that are not necessarily the one where wholesale bank operate today, and go at them through maybe more the innovation lab or the kind of innovation budget, so that it doesn't disrupt the existing business line. Areas here where we think about Nomura is around digital asset in particular. I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later, but the significant opportunities that this offers in terms of new product, new revenue, new clients, but also different business model. So for example, you know, opportunities such as spinning off internal asset, trying to monetize them and building software as a service kind of business model. So those are the type of innovation that we're looking at. I don't think there's necessarily a standard playbook, but you need to evaluate where you're starting from, what strengths do you have, what are some of the kind of broad strategic objectives of the bank in order to build your approach on both kind of incremental opportunities and the disruptive one.
Thank you, Olivier. So it sounds like leveraging data and new asset classes moving from the periphery to the core is going to be a big thing here. Judge, just back to you. I think we've mentioned already one of the core differentiators about retail banking from other business lines is that the customer experience and interaction has to be a key consideration. So it seems that many digital solutions could offer greater customization of products and services, for example, using transaction data to provide more immediate access to credit. Maybe how do banks maintain a good level of intimacy and trust with customers as channels move from in-person to digital? Can and should more physical elements of customer interaction be retained in digital banking models?
Yeah, Bob, a very good question. And, you know, with these digital channels, the lack of personalization is a potential issue, or at least a consideration. It's my own view that banks potentially become commoditized relative to fintechs or challenger banks, meaning you don't have that personal interaction. There's no differentiation between a traditional bank and some of these startup banks. There's really no differentiation between any banks when you think about it. In addition, another issue or challenge for banks is that data is so disparate, particularly in large banks. But with the amount of data, there's a great opportunity for hyper-personalization. And a couple examples around that would be, one, the ability to communicate with your customer, personalize the interaction through the mobile phone. So banks generally know through the mobile phone where customers are and what they're doing. So if a customer is at a soccer match and the bank knows that, they can text that customer to say, hope you're enjoying the match. You know, notice our bank advertisement on one end of the field. And by the way, buy a free drink on us. Enjoy it. Look forward to, you know, hearing how the soccer match went. Second example of customizing and also the ability to cross sell is a bank can monitor if an individual, just as an example, is looking at a foreign currency. And they may observe or may be able to track that a customer is looking at the euro currency 3 times a day. So they can either text that customer information more about the euro currency, just to say, thought you'd be interested in this, or we have the capability to trade and contact this phone number if you're interested. And then the other example around customization or personalization is more around selling. And the example I'm going to give has been very, I think, traditional, have been around. So if a bank has a 25-year-old customer, most likely they're going to sell a mortgage product or look to sell a mortgage product. If it's an emerging wealth customer, potentially their wealth advisory capabilities. But with data, there's ability to make it even more personal and more specific both for the bank and customer. And a good example may be that customer, or they observe that that customer goes on 3 ski vacations per year. I mean, they know that just from transactional data and other ways of monitoring. So the bank has the ability to say to that customer, we know you like skiing, not quite in those words, but we know you like skiing. We have branch capabilities in the following ski resorts. We also sell mortgage services in those same locations. So if you're interested in buying a second home, please contact our branch in a certain ski resort area. We'd be happy to work with you on buying a second home. And again, I'm paraphrasing the words a little bit. It's not quite that way. But I think the point is being made just around with transactional data, the ability to personalize selling and provide more support to the customer.
Thank you, Jada. Olivier, just expanding on customer experience and value-added services, the regulatory trend towards open banking regimes is allowing more third parties to leverage banking data for their own products and services. And while this could diminish the market share of incumbent financial institutions, open banking could also drive greater innovation from banks. From your perspective, how could possibly wholesale banks partner and collaborate rather than compete with these new entrants and select the appropriate partners for better product development and servicing?
This is not a easy one to solve, because obviously some of those kind of new entrants and fintech are going after some of the same clients as us. Here, I think especially around some of the non-bank liquidity provider, in particular on the FX space, that have aggressively, based on technology, capture market share on some of the FX market. And so, you know, some of them are competitors and some we would like to partner with. So I think it depends a lot on the asset class, the business, and again, you know, your relative strengths in that specific business. So I don't think there's one answer that fits all. But for us, a player like Nomura, which is smaller than some of the, you know, large universal banks in Europe, US, or other mega banks in Japan, it allows us to act sometimes in a more nimble and entrepreneurial way, which can have a higher impact on a dollar for dollar spend. And that's really how we think about the partnership with tech companies. And I'd say also being maybe slightly smaller or case for change if anything is maybe a bit more pressing than the large banks who have a more captive client base, such as a corporate segment or high net worth. Whereas for us, institutional clients may move faster. So in a way, we're forced to deal with the disruption ahead of some of the larger organization and deal in a way that is aligned to our resource. And therefore, we have developed this relatively flexible approach for JV and partnership with a tech company, where what we bring onto the table is sometimes capital, and we would invest in some of those kind of fintech player. But also, more importantly, I think for a lot of us is we can bring some of our IP, some of our domain expertise to support a new player, a new entrant. And assuming that we have an equity stake in them, then it allows us for greater valuation gain by, example, Nomura acting as a first client or Nomura providing some IP and some expertise. And I'll give you an example here where recently we've partnered with an AI company where jointly we develop AI market making for fixed income products. And AI company had relatively good kind of general AI capabilities, but lacked some of the kind of a domain expertise. Whereas us, obviously, being a sales organization, we have that depth of expertise, but the challenges for us to build such a complex kind of product with sometimes the difficulties to attract and retain talent meant that we felt more comfortable partnering here with this AI player to develop a solution that is now being rolled out at Nomura. And that's typically an approach where it's a win-win situation for both the fintech company and for us as a sales institution, where some of the kind of tools are developed much faster than if they were built internally. But at the same time, that startup can then, assuming there's no IP issue and so on, sell that solution to other banks and therefore drive higher valuation, where here we would benefit from that. We would do that, and in particular on this ownership or trying to take equity stake, where it's a top-line driven approach, where there is really some alpha, and here we want to have a seat at the table of a fintech company, drive, influence the strategic direction. When it comes to leveraging technology more for efficiency or improving your controls, here our view, at least again from our starting point, is to partner with more established players, established fintech who have done it already at other banks so that they have built their domain expertise with our players. And here we can just license the solution as opposed to try to help shape the product in any way or form. So that's I think how we think about the way to partner with some of those new entrants, both from a top line kind of a revenue opportunity versus one where it's a more around efficiency.
Thank you, Olivier. One of the hallmarks of 2020 is the expansion of research from many central banks into digital sovereign fiat or CBDCs. Single tier models involving direct issuance of central bank money could disrupt and disintermediate some banking services. Alternatively, a two-tier model like the PBOC's DSEP keeps commercial banks involved in their consumer-facing functions. So maybe how can international banks prepare over a longer term for potential introduction of both types of CBDC issuance models in different jurisdictions in the future?
Hey, Bob, and so very good question. You know, maybe worth just, you know, for the world to define CBDC, which is central bank digital currency. As you alluded to, we're seeing a two-tier model, although disintermediation has not taken place yet, meaning things like chips and SWIFT and other electronic payments continue. Not that this mitigates the point, but, you know, in the country I sit in, the U.S., they're catching up with real-time payments or faster payments relative to countries like the U.K. Or Australia. But having said that, I think the big consideration is, and as you alluded to in the question, is that the consumer can set up an account directly with the central bank, which potentially disintermediates the traditional banks. So this whole issue is emerging. I advise on 3 points, which is one, to engage with an organization called the Atlantic Council Geoeconomic Center, which is driving discussion around private and public sectors to advise and to emerge or to develop policy. Two, to participate in research and development efforts with central banks first, or who are first movers in certain countries. And then finally, to invest in, and I almost will use the word embrace, but I'll say invest in the development of core capabilities, including digital custody, which are required to engage safely and securely in CBDC systems. But I'm going to come back to my point again. I mean, it's an issue that's quickly emerging and something we need to pay attention to. I don't think it's an issue yet. There has not been disintermediation yet. Clearly, the two payment mechanisms continue, but it's something worth watching closely.
Considering the impact of digital asset issuance like crypto, security token offerings and stablecoins, how should maybe institutions prepare for a new asset class and the demand from investors for these?
I agree with Jude with regards to CBDC, but it's not an issue yet. Although here sitting in Hong Kong, we see the kind of a digital yuan in China getting some scale, and you know the pilots that are ongoing in multiple cities are showing that this could come much faster than sometimes what we anticipate in the Western world. But no, there's no doubt that when CBDC will become more prevalent, it will have significant implications for banks, both on their client service model, the type of new products that they can offer to their clients, and of course, all the post-trade aspect of it, ranging from real-time settlement to a custody and so on. And actually, I don't know which model will prevail. Is it the wholesale CBDC? Is it the retail CBDC? You know, my personal view is that in most countries we'll end up with maybe a more of a hybrid model, where there may be wholesale CBDC issuance to commercial banks, and then various private stablecoin operators will be able to interoperate with a wholesale CBDC and offer a service to the retail. That's the experience of, you know, private companies. They know how to build a digital wallet. They know how to build user experience that meets the need of retail, and honestly, what a central bank should focus on. So how to prepare for it as a kind of financial institution, given beyond China, there's not really any kind of project that has any kind of scale. Our view here is that we should be active in what most closely resemble CBDCs, and today it is really a digital asset, and especially crypto. And most of the CBDCs are likely going to use a form of distributed ledger technology for the underlying kind of technology for the issuance. So being active in crypto today helps banks to prepare with some of the kind of challenges and opportunities associated to that. crypto in itself being obviously a very interesting asset class and getting more and more institutionalized, as I've mentioned. But once CBDC comes more prevalent, it will act really as a significant on-ramp for digital asset, security token. Issuance will become very quickly token-based and will transform the way corporate or startup will raise capital. And a whole new set of asset class also are likely to be tokenized from, you know, fairly liquid kind of asset to over type of fund. And banks will have to handle both. So it's not just around your kind of currency operation, but you'll have to transform your business, but it's all across the value chain from primary to secondary to post-trade. The risk here, if banks don't prepare for that, then they will become disintermediated by the tech player. And we start to see the, you know, early play of that through DeFi, decentralized finance, which potentially will accelerate the kind of disruption for the industry, where you replace, in a way, all of the kind of financial incumbents really through the use of smart contracts. Of course, there's a lot of work in progress. It's still an early stage technology, but it's a very exciting space in finance and potentially could bypass some of the kind of centralized player. And, you know, in my view, the regulators may not look to protect the incumbents. You know, their role is to assess the kind of interest of protect the interest of the investors and the market, but not necessarily the existing banks. So that's why I think it's critical to get ready for that. And, you know, through looking at what crypto and digital asset kind of create in terms of opportunities and transformation of your process, that seems like a good way to prepare for CBDCs and put some of those foundation in place.
Thank you, Olivier. On that final point, this concludes today's podcast. Thank you for joining us today, Judd and Olivier. It has been a pleasure to speak with both of you. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We are both on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.